So audience participation this morning. A couple questions for you. First question is, what keeps you up at night? Just shout it out. Your job, okay? Yes, others. People, work, what else keeps you up at night? What makes it hard to sleep? Worry, yes, worries. Anything else? Politics, yes. Others? What's that? The world, yes. Similar question, but the exact opposite. What's your reason for waking up in the morning? And don't say your alarm clock. What brings a smile to your face? What's your reason for getting up? Yeah.
Experience a new day.
A new day? Yep, absolutely. Others? Coffee. Yes, coffee, definitely. Hope, Jesus, others.
Kids,
yes. Anything else?
Sunshine,
yes. Great time for sunshine. It's like that perfect temperature where it's not too hot right now. It's like a fever just broke for the entire city. So, friends, what I'm wondering today is, of these two things, of the things that just fill you with dread and of the things that fill you with both hope and with joy, which do you focus on more? I'm wondering which occupies more of your headspace these days. Have you been focusing your energy on what sustains you or what drains you? Again, today is week two of this 8-week series on Revelation. And last week, we talked about the form of the book. We talked first about what Revelation is not. Revelation is not a one-to-one end times prophecy. That's not how it works. And we also talked about what Revelation is. And what Revelation is it is at its heart a letter by a guy written to seven churches. That's it. And these seven churches are coming at this really tender time, and they're being crushed under the weight of the Roman Empire. And so as a result, this book, Revelation, is an act of imaginative civil resistance. And John, who is writing the book, is challenging the church to imagine both a better church and a better world. We're on chapter 5 now, and again, just to catch you up on everything that's happened over the past week, John spends significant time in both chapter 2 and 3 directly addressing each of these seven churches. And John reflects to them all of their joys, their hopes, their fears, their anxieties. John reflects all of it. And John, in the process, paints this picture of the church in its infancy. These new worshiping communities are sprouting from the ground, and at the same time, they are being trampled upon by the Roman government. And John begins his letter by focusing on the churches for the simple fact that, for John, the church is kind of all we've got. It's a community that matters. It's a broken community. It's a fallible community. There's people bickering all the time. And John lays all of that out plainly in the page. There is fighting going on the inside. There are pressures on the people from the outside. It's almost like John is opening his letter with a State of the Union address. And he is just reminding all of these people, these churches, that this is all we have. Our churches, our God, and each other. And so he tells his people, let's cherish this community and let's use it well. You may also remember that John has been exiled. He's been exiled to an island called Patmos, and he is there writing in coded language. And this coded language is not some like weird end times imagery as much as it is a practical tool so that his message won't be interpreted and then intercepted by the Roman authorities. And so understanding that really helps us understand what comes next in chapter 4. We get this really strange and surreal worship scene where suddenly a lion comes out of nowhere. And then there's an ox, and then there's a human, and then there's an eagle, and they all have a whole bunch of wings. There's so many wings. And they're all worshiping, and then John suddenly describes these beings as descending from heaven. And then suddenly there's a scroll. And the scroll has been sealed completely shut. And John looks around, and John wonders, who can open this thing? Who can open this scroll? The scroll is kind of like Thor's hammer. You've got to be worthy to open this thing. And he looks around. We're in chapter 5 now. We've read this. We've read how he looks around, and he begins to cry because no one is worthy to open this scroll. No one on earth, not even these strange beings that have descended from heaven. The good news, if that is what this scroll is, it remains locked away. It remains completely sealed. And so an elder comes to John, and the elder says, John, you don't need to cry. There has been a conqueror, and that conqueror is going to open the scroll. And if you were there in John's day and you heard that word, conqueror, that's going to bring up all sorts of baggage, all sorts of connotations. Conqueror is a charged word. If you're there in John's day and you hear conqueror, you're going to think empire, you're going to think Rome, you're going to think Pax Romana, you're going to think all of those things that have threatened your way of life. You are going to think about all of those things we just named. You're going to think about all of those things that keep you up personally at night, sleeping with one eye open, and you're going to fear. You're going to fear that these conquerors, these lions, have suddenly taken hold of the scroll and that they're never giving it back. So the elder says, look for the conqueror. Look for the lion. So John turns and John sees a lamb. A lamb. It catches John by surprise. A lamb. Now that same voice that says, look for the lion, now says, here he is, the lion is the lamb. The conqueror is the conquered. The one who laid down his life now lies at the center of it all, stronger even than the empire who hurt him, stronger than the empire who hurt you. We were expecting a lion, and we got a lamb. We were expecting Rome. We were expecting empires like Rome. But here at the center lies something else, something bleeding and small and vulnerable. It's a lamb who opens the scroll, a lamb who alone is worthy, a lamb around which everything else rotates. So John tells his readers, place your attention here. Look less for the lion and look more for the lamb. Focus less on those things that keep you going at night and turn instead to your reason for waking up in the morning. There's a line in the movie Lady Bird, our main character. She's talking about college admissions. She's sitting with a guidance counselor at what is basically St. Francis. And the counselor says to her after reading her essay, she says, you write about Sacramento so affectionately and with such care. And this really bothers Lady Bird because she hates Sacramento. She just wants to get out of the city as soon as she graduates from high school. And so she kind of scoffs at the guidance counselor, and she says, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I guess I pay attention. And the counselor responds by saying, Don't you think maybe they're the same thing? Love and attention. Friends, where are you placing your attention these days? Where are you placing your attention? We do not always know what we worship, but our attention gives us away. I'm not always proud of how I spend my attention. I do doom scroll way too frequently at night, and I had a nightmare recently, a couple days ago. It was a nightmare about ICE, which, like, I'm probably safe. But I had the nightmare anyway. And I do a lot of volunteering at the John Moss Building through SACAC, NorCal Resist. And so I had this dream. I was going home from work, and I was followed by a couple of vans from ICE. And I stopped at home, and I was going to pick my son up from school. He's in kindergarten. And I went through the gate. I waited for him. They released him. I held his hand, and I looked out the gate, and the same folks that had followed me were waiting for us outside of the gate, and I was there holding my son's hand and afraid to leave the school. And I was really worried about Pierre. I worry about him a lot these days. I worry about lions. And in today's scripture, John takes me and others like me, maybe you as well, John takes us by the chin and says, look also at the Lamb, because true love lies here. Love lies with what sustains us, again, not what drains us. Friends, at the risk of sounding too Christian during church, Revelation basically says, remember to worship, people. Remember to worship. That's really what it comes down to. Remember to worship. If your center is out of alignment, you will be no good for others. If you have lost sight of the Lamb, you will know only lions. If you have lost your ability to dream, you will only have nightmares. Here in the opening chapters of Revelation, John is reminding his people, these churches that are exhausted and terrified and vigilant and on edge and bickering, he reminds them that the single most profound act of resistance is worship. Worship not with closed fists, but with open palms, not with hate, but with love, not with lions, but with lambs, not violence, not domination, but with sacrifice, with solidarity. The most powerful thing that we can do is gather together and proclaim a better way, the way of the Lamb, the way of Jesus. This is how the sealed scroll opens up, not through conquest, but through a love that is willing to be wounded, that risks something. Not through the roar of empire, but through the quiet and steady bleat of a lamb who was slain and still stands, who limps and who has matted wool and who still won't stop moving and loving. There's another movie. This one came out in Japan in the 50s. It's a Kurosawa film. It's called Ikaru. And Ikaru is about this buttoned-up bureaucrat. He's not quite a Scrooge character, but he's pretty close. He's this government worker who has spent his entire life attending to the machinery of a system that does not need him. And he has this son who he barely knows. He has a desk that is just littered with paperwork that doesn't matter. And this cubicle is his entire life. It's been this way for decades. And then suddenly the man discovers that he is dying. and he has 6 months to live. At this point, a voiceover interrupts the film, and it tells the audience, it reassures us, it says, it's okay, he's already been dead for 20 years, he just didn't know it yet. So the movie keeps going, he receives the diagnosis, and even after finding out that he's dying that same day, he punches back into work. This is all that he knows, these papers. Of course, the papers do not love him back. And he slowly realizes that he has spent his whole life focused on completely the wrong things. Not really living, just treading water. And it would all be horribly depressing and way too real if not for what comes next. He remembers a paper. It's buried in his desk somewhere. It's a proposal for a public park, a new playground. And there's all sorts of red tape, and he'd have to step way outside of his cubicle to push this through. But for the first time in his life, our bureaucrat finds a reason to live. He finds something worth waking up for in the morning. He finds something worth believing in and doing. And suddenly everything starts to change. He becomes less insular. He remembers how to laugh again. He finally tells his son about his diagnosis. And in the film's final image, we see a dying man in his work suit, outside, by himself in thick snow, sitting on a swing set for the park that he has just built. And he's singing. The song's name is Life is Beautiful. And the name of the movie, Icaru, simply means to live. May we all live. Now and forever. Amen.